science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now we have AUT's Alan Blackman joining Will and Ruben and I in the studio to talk about some science news. How are you this lovely Wednesday, Alan?
I'm very good. Can't complain. It's not
you
raining.
You sort of said that and like unsure, like, I think I'm good. Yeah. No complaints. Yeah,
never sure how to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, there is the default answer, like, yeah, I'm good, when you're actually like kind of shit inside.
Indeed.
And you don't want to like go into the big spiel. It's just like, let's make this easy. Say good. Anyway, so first up, we see that archaeologists have discovered evidence that Aboriginals have been living in Australia for at least 65,000 years, which is a little bit longer than previously thought.
Indeed. So up until, I guess now, people had thought that the Aboriginals arrived in Australia around about 50,000 or so years ago. And a lot of this is based on a dating method that probably a lot of you have heard of out there in radio land called carbon dating or radiocarbon dating. And the way that that works is that you use this to date things that were once living. In other words, basically that they're based on carbon. Things like trees, wood, all that sort of stuff. And the carbon component of that, or the radioactive carbon component of that, because there's a little bit of radioactive carbon in all sources of carbon, and that eventually decays away once the object stops growing. Once it's died, then that starts decaying. And from the amount of this radioactive carbon isotope, carbon-14, that's left, you can figure out the time since whatever it was died. So the trouble with radiocarbon dating is that it only works over a time period of around about 50,000 or so years. And anything longer than that, it's pretty much useless because all of the carbon has decayed away after that time. The carbon's got a half-life of about 5,000 years. You can use this method for 10 times a half-life. So what they need is possibly a better method of dating objects. And so what they have got in Australia, what they've used is this thing called optically stimulated luminescence. Which sounds fantastic. It's kind of cool. And so with respect to this recent discovery, what they found was a batch of artifacts, about 11,000 artifacts, and they're all buried in sand to a depth around about 2.6 meters. And what they've done with this is that the sand that's surrounding these artifacts, they can figure out the last time that sand saw the sun. In other words,
that's a mouthful. Last time the sand saw the sun.
Yes, alliterative too. So they can figure out that, which means that they can figure out the time since those items were buried.
Mm.
Okay, and the way that this works, in brief, is that the sand, the structure of sand, which are just quartz, should be perfect, but it's not. It's got little imperfections in it. Okay, and in these little imperfections, you can get electrons stuck. And the way that they get stuck there is that they absorb light from the sun and some of these electrons get stuck. And when they get buried, they can't get unstuck, basically. Mm. So they're sort of stuck in these holes, we call them, electron holes in the quartz. And it's not until the sand then gets exposed to light again that those electrons can get out. And when they get out, they just pop out a little bit of light as well.
Mm.
Okay. And if you analyze the intensity of that light, you can figure out how long it's been since the quartz or the grain of sand or whatever last saw the light. So that's the technique that they're using for this. And so now they're dating this to around about sort of 65,000 to 80,000 years since Aborigines inhabited Australia, which means that all of the anthropologists around the place are going to have to rethink their dates for the time when humans left Africa, because that's what happened.
Totally.
That's where we all came from. So we all came from Africa. And so this is going to push the dating of that back probably another sort of 15 to maybe 30,000 odd years. And it's also got the effect of saying that the early Aborigines must have interacted with a bunch of megafauna in Australia for a lot longer time than was previously thought. So they had things like giant wombats and stuff in Australia, which people thought that as soon as the Aborigines came in, that everything got killed off by the Aborigines. But that doesn't appear to be the case now. If these numbers are correct, then that means that the Aborigines were coexisting with these megafauna for a lot longer period of time. So it's a, you know, fascinating scientific technique that they're using, and it's got real big implications for basically the history of humankind, I guess.
Right, I see, because the article that you sent spoke about the out of Africa theory, so that's what you're referring to with that, that actually has massive ramifications beyond just sort of learning a little bit more about Australian Aboriginals. It's way, way bigger than that.
Yeah, so basically, you know, back to where we all came from, and so the timing of that is all important, and now the timing of that's certainly got to be looked into again because of these results. Mm. So, you know, very, very nice work. And the beauty of this is that it's in Kakadu National Park up in the Northern Territory, this place, and it's completely owned by the native Aborigines. And so they basically control the entire archaeological dig. And so everything belongs to them, and you know, I think that's pretty cool. They're not getting their sort of culture stolen or anything like that. So
what exactly has been found there using this dating?
Yeah, from what I could see, it's a whole lot of sort of stone implements. So they found the oldest, I think, ground axe head. So instead of just sort of chipping it off like flint, so they've actually ground it to a sharp edge, which is, you know, kind of a rarity for that time. So basically, most of the things were stone. There's a fireplace as well, so they can use the radiocarbon dating there for however accurate that is. But primarily, you're looking at minerals, and that's where this process, this new method, is very, very good.
Right. So they dug and dug and dug and found these artifacts, yep, and then the electrons that were buried at the same level.
Yes. Yes. Yep.
Okay,
yep,
right. So yep, they shone light, and then they were like, okay, yeah, gotcha.
That's exactly
this
it.
This is my non-scientific summary of like
simplified optically stimulated luminescence. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So there you go.
And well, like carbon dating, is there a limit on this new way of dating, or does it have like a
Seemingly not, actually. It's not dependent on the amount of an isotope like carbon dating is. So my very, very small knowledge of it, I don't think so. I think this is okay. It just depends on the number of electrons that it's actually got in there trapped. And provided there's enough to get a decent signal out and you can integrate that signal, then there shouldn't be any limit, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So now our next story comes from a great titled article by The Independent in the UK, which was ISIS failed to build dirty bomb because they, quote, aren't that smart. So tell me a bit of background about this. What's this all about?
Okay, well, I guess the science content in this is a little bit minimal, but the stupidity content is just off the scale, I would say. But anyway, so everyone's heard of Mosul, horrible place to be in over the last X number of years, controlled by ISIS, and it's been recently liberated by the Iraqis with a bit of help from the Americans, et cetera, et cetera. And it was known when ISIL took over Mosul that there were a couple of machines in the university there that relied on the radioactive isotope cobalt 60. And so these machines are basically for the treatment of cancer, okay? And that's what cobalt 60 is used for. So it's very, very intense radiation, and you can basically kill cancer cells using this. Obviously, because it's very, very radioactive, then it doesn't only kill cancer cells, it kills normal cells, et cetera, et cetera. So what I guess everyone was fearing was that ISIL is going to get their hands on this stuff, stick it into some sort of a normal bomb and disperse it very rapidly over a populated area and thereby condemning everybody to radiation sickness, which is what a so-called dirty bomb is.
Okay.
So it's not a nuclear bomb or anything like that. It's just a normal bomb, but you're just spreading radioactive stuff all over the show. This cobalt 60 is nasty radioactive stuff. And so that was the fear that ISIL would come up with this. Thankfully, it didn't happen. So after they liberated Mosul, they went to the university and they found that these two caches of cobalt-60 were still there, thankfully. Then some guy from the health ministry went and said that that ISIS never managed to build a bomb because they're too stupid, basically. Now, number one, my question is, why was this reported at all in the media? I mean, what's the point of reporting this? Because all it's going to do is make people aware of the possibility of this sort of dirty bomb thing going on. It's going to get them worried. And number two, don't call people stupid because they'll just try and prove you wrong. You know, it really didn't seem to be the most sensible thing in the world to say. So, thankfully, I guess, at the moment, the world is still devoid of dirty bombs, but the fact that this has gone all around the world and has been reported all around the world, does that increase the chance of a dirty bomb being made?
Totally.
I would have thought it would have, but I'm just a chemistry lecturer, so what do I know?
And I guess, you know, the situation in Iraq as well is not obviously the most stable.
No, indeed not.
So it's kind of like, it's, you know, is that kind of a dumb thing to publicise? We've just got Mosul.
Yep.
You guys forgot about this thing. Shame, but...
And, you know, there's radiotherapy machines all over the world. There's cobalt-60 sources, you know, everywhere. There's nuclear medicine departments and all sort of, you know, decent-sized hospitals all around the world. You know, if you're really, really serious about it, of course you can get your hands on some nuclear material, radioactive, whatever. So let's just hope it doesn't happen.
So when you say you just put this radioactive material in a bomb and then blow up the bomb, is that literally how simple it is? You don't need to have really much scientific background.
Well, you've got to not kill yourself with the radioactive stuff to begin
with. Very important,
yes. That's kind of the limiting step, hence the not very smart comment, I think, because...
Right.
You know, implying that they couldn't sort of get the cobalt out of the shield without killing themselves.
Right, so you need some sort of knowledge. Not
you
any,
do, yes, yeah. You do, yeah, yeah. But really, you know, theoretically, that's all that you have to do.
Do we know if ISIS knew about the cobalt?
I've got a feeling that they did. I thought that in one of the articles I read that the implication was there that they were making threats that they might be doing this. So, right. Yeah.
What, in regards to their intentions, why would they actually even do it, though? I mean, they would cause the whole city to be radioactive, and what's the point of having a city that you can't live in?
Well, maybe they just, I don't know, fly to Baghdad and drop it over Baghdad. I don't know. I mean, we're trying to explain the minds of...
Yeah. I guess if you're intent on destruction...
Then it doesn't matter
to
because...
To fuel fear in, you know, through the media, then...
Yes.
It's a possible action you might consider.
You know, if we can't have the city, then you're not going to have it higher. No. Yeah.
So just quickly moving on to the final story today, we're talking about the synthetic cannabis epidemic. Sweeping New Zealand and Auckland police have reported that it's killed people. What are some of the issues around calling it synthetic cannabis firstly?
And that's exactly my point on this. Now, you know, drugs, that's your choice. You want to do it, that's totally up to you. But... this stuff is being sort of spoken of as being synthetic cannabis when it's nothing of the sort. It's they're totally different materials. And labelling it as being synthetic cannabis sort of speaks to it being somewhat benign as cannabis is. So you're saying it's some derivative of cannabis. Now, if you want to get into the science of it, the reason perhaps that these things are called synthetic cannabis, or more correctly synthetic cannabinoids, is that they go to the same areas in the brain, the same receptors in the brain that cannabis does. Now, the stuff in cannabis that makes you feel high is this thing called, well, one of them anyway, is the thing called THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is a molecule, and a molecule that's got a particular shape that fits into the cannabinoid receptors in the brain. And these cannabinoid receptors were found sort of around about the 1980s, and there's two different types of them. And that's what happens when you're smoking dope. So people have been interested in making molecules that seem to have sort of similar effects or bind to the same receptors in the brain as do the psychoactive materials in dope. And so there's a guy by the name of John Huffman, Professor John Huffman from Clemson University, who spent 20 years basically making a lot of these molecules which appeared to do the same thing as cannabis, certainly bind to the same receptors in the brain as cannabis does. And they were very, very different chemically, very different chemically from these cannabinoids. So that's sort of the reason why they're calling it synthetic cannabis, because these molecules that he made, they're quote-unquote synthetic rather than occurring naturally. But supposedly they're acting on the same centers in the brain as cannabis does. So he himself, this guy, said you'd have to be crazy to take these things. Okay, they've done lots of studies and everything and trying to figure out the way the brain works, et cetera, et cetera. So they will have done lots of, you know, animal studies, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're smoking this stuff, you just don't know what's in it, number one. You know, that's the thing. So the police are saying they've found traces of weed killer, fly spray, that sort of stuff. And it's not related to cannabis. And if you think it's safe because it's got cannabis in the name, then think again, because, you know, 7 people died last month with this stuff, supposedly. So it's the name that I am just so opposed to. I think it's horrible. Call this stuff what it really is, but don't call
unknown
it anything.
Unknown chemicals.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Oh, look, here's something that you don't know what it is. See what this does, you know? Yeah.
Well, the media aren't helping either, because I've seen articles where they're showing literally cannabis, normal cannabis, and saying synthetic cannabis is hurting people. So everyone's looking at normal cannabis and being like, oh, it looks like the normal stuff.
Indeed.
I can do it anyway.
Yep. And, you know, it's, to my understanding, I've never actually seen it, but, you know, it's just sort of plant material that, you know, made up to look up like dope and sprayed with whatever psychoactive substance these rogue chemists, and sadly they are chemists, are making these days.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and of course part of the problem is because we don't know what it is, we don't know whether it's legal or, well, we know that it's not illegal because in order to be rendered illegal, it's got to have a particular chemical structure. We've got to know actually what the stuff is. If you don't, then you can't make it illegal.
Well, exactly. I mean, that isn't that the whole thing with these, I mean, these legal highs, that the manufacturers are kind of always one step ahead of policymakers, and so just making little tweaks here and there.
Yes, absolutely.
And then having to, then the policymakers just always trying to have to catch up.
Yes, yeah. And I think we talked about this a few months ago with pee and this derivative of pee that is now seemingly flooding the market. That's not illegal because nobody's made it illegal, but, you know, it's one chemical step and bam, you've got pee. So if you've got the precursor, you can very easily make pee. So we're fighting a losing battle on that one, sadly. Mm. It's all got to be retrospective.
Yeah,
it has to be. You know, you find this dangerous drug on the streets and then you make it illegal rather than the other way around. So, and of course, making it illegal doesn't stop things anyway. So, witness marijuana. So,
yeah.
Do you think this just gives credence to the calls for legalizing actual cannabis?
I feel like logically right, but then who really knows? Because I feel like it's almost such like a moral issue in New Zealand and we can't really move past that.
Well,
we haven't been able to move past that, but yeah, I mean, I feel like logically that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a debate for another day, surely, but everyone around the world seems to be heading that way, so I think probably New Zealand will end up going that way as well, and then you can monitor it, you can regulate it, you can tax it.
All of these great things.
Yay, tax.
Indeed, but, you know, it might make things safer, but God, that seems like a poor reason to have to do it, doesn't it? Because we've got nasty stuff out there.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. But it's like, oh, I guess we'll make it legal because of the dangers of synthetic cannabis, when there's actually all of these other really robust arguments around the legalization of
absolutely.
Cannabis that have been
agreed,
you know, talked about for years now. If this is the thing that does it, it's like, well, thank you very much for joining us once again, Alan.
Not a problem.
We shall chat to you again next week.
Cool. Okay, see you guys.
That was Dear Science.